Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, "There is no God." His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, "I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity." His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. He says in his heart, "God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it." Arise, O Lord, lift up your hand, forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, "You will not call to account"? But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and the evildoer. Call his wickedness to account till you find none. The Lord is king forever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. So we have a psalm that is a cry from the psalmist for the afflictions that are going on around him. And he is contrasting the way in which the wicked are coming against the righteous, and the way that the wicked are oppressing the poor and doing injustices, and the way that they take that question onto themselves and are able to justify their actions and their behaviors. In many ways, the psalm is timeless. You know, I think that we could say there's so much in here that reminds us of our own maybe cultural conflicts that we're having. But I imagine that 25 years ago, you could have read the psalm and say that it was timeless. In 100 years, and 200 years, and 1,000 years, and going back to the fact that it's a 3,000-year-old song, it is timeless, because these sorts of events are events that continue even until the Lord Jesus returns. So the psalm begins with a moral question, and it's a moral question in verse 1. And the question is, it's actually two questions. It's, why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? And again, this is a perpetual question of morality, a question that is perpetual, and a prayer among the people of God that every generation of the church prays. And this experience is not something that is only something that is experienced by the church as a whole, but it's also something that individual believers experience from time to time. Now, I'm not saying that this is always your experience. You know, I believe that we should have assurance of faith, and I think that there should be times when We have, you know, we've talked about like mountaintop spiritual experiences. There is a place for all of that in the Christian life. But there is also a place for these times when it seems as though God is far away. Our own confession of faith talks about how sometimes God will withdraw his hand from the believer. And that gives us a greater sense of need, a greater sense of reliance upon him that causes us to come in and to hold on to the Lord. So we have these questions. Why do you stand far away, or why do you stand off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Now, despite the fact that these questions arise and they're part of the church experience, they're part of the individual believer experience, they're also part of the experience of the Lord Jesus Christ as he suffered. The sense of being forsaken by the Father was part of the experience of the Lord Jesus Christ as well. And we need to remember that. So we have these two questions. Why do you stand off? Why do you hide yourself? And despite these questions and despite sort of the timelessness of the questions, as I've mentioned, I want to encourage you that the answers are not unanswerable. The psalmist finds hope in the psalm, and we should find hope. If these are questions that are on your heart right now, there is hope, and the hope comes from the Lord. Now, why is the psalmist asking these questions? Well, we see in verses 2 through 11 that the arrogance of the wicked is really the reason behind why the psalmist is answering these questions. The psalmist looks out and he sees that the wicked go on and do wicked things, and in their wickedness, they are arrogant. There's not a humility that says that they will be caught or that they will suffer the consequences or that God will hold them accountable. There is instead an arrogance that occurs. We see in verse 2, in arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. There is oppression against the poor. There is scheming that occurs. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. We've talked several weeks about the theme in the Psalter of the wicked being caught by their own scheme. It is the downfall of the downfall of the wicked is that which the wicked set up. That is generally the way it works in providence. They fall because they have set up schemes that they devised. And we see that even as the psalmist prays this prayer, let them be caught, there is an admission that this is happening, that there is scheming. Verse 3 tells us of greed and of cursing and of boasting. In the pride and the arrogance, they are boasting of wickedness. They are greedy for greater gain. There is a violation of the third commandment as they're cursing the Lord and renouncing the Lord. So you see this wickedness is just piling up and piling up. Verse 4 talks about the pride of his face. But I want you to notice some other things as well. I mentioned the third commandment violation in the cursing. That's blasphemy. There's a vanity in that as well. But in this pride, in this arrogance of the wicked, there is also perceived innocence. You know, the wicked look out at these schemes and there is a perception that what they are doing is okay. Verse 4 says, in the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him, does not seek God. So he's assuming that he's fine. Verse 6, he says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all the generations, I shall not meet adversity. Just, I'm doing fine. Verse 11, he says in his heart, God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will not see it. In verse 13, he says, you will not call to account. So even though there may be a sense of him understanding that there is a judicial guilt, there's not a moral responsibility where the wicked sees that he will be held accountable, that guilt is something that is imputed to him. Maybe he just sees it as he is guilty and that guilt is just out there floating around rather than that guilt being imputed upon him. And we see also, I read a couple of them, that the arrogance of the wicked, we see the atheism as well. There is no God. That's what his thoughts are. And it says all of his thoughts are that. There is a repeating of this pattern of there is no God, there is no God, there is no God. Now, an interesting study that came out a few years ago was on the anti-atheistic writings of the 16th century in England. And this modern scholar really struggled with whether atheism even existed in England during the 16th century. And he investigates all of this writing, polemical writing against atheism in England. And he's saying, I can't find evidence of atheism in the land, or in writing at least. Now, we have to understand that in the scriptures, the idea of atheism isn't always that God doesn't exist. Notice that the psalmist, his mind and his thoughts keep going to there is no God, there is no God. But look at verse 11. Verse 11 says, God has forgotten, he has hidden his face, he will never see it. In verse 13, he says in his heart, God will not call to account. So we see those contradictions of the arrogance of the wicked, even within his own mind. He's wrestling through this conflict that says there is no God. And why is he saying that? Well, he's trying to numb his conscience to the fact that he knows that God will hold him accountable and that God will at one day call him to account. There is a contradiction in the atheism. And this is how atheism often, or at least used to be, written about. You know, there weren't many people that would say, yeah, I don't believe in God at all. There would be those that live in such a way as though there is no God. And that's what the wicked are doing here. And the psalmist is calling them out for that and praying that the Lord would take care of that. Now, one commentator said, the pride of the wicked is the principal reason why they will not seek after the knowledge of God. Pride consists in an unduly exalted opinion of oneself. It's therefore impatient of a rival. It hates a superior. It can't endure a master. In proportion, it makes us wish to see nothing above us and to acknowledge no law but our own will and to follow no rule but our own inclinations. This thus led Satan to rebel against the Creator, our first parents to desire to be as gods, and such effects of pride is evident that nothing can be more painful to a proud heart than the thoughts of such being as God, one who is infinitely powerful, just, and holy, and who can neither be resisted, deceived, deluded, who disposes according to his own sovereign pleasure of all creatures and events, and who, in a special manner, hates pride and is determined to punish it. So we see that in the wicked, this arrogance that has set him up as God, and as he sets him up in a higher place than God. What he ends up doing is he's oppressing the poor. He is acting wickedly. He's being unjust to those around him. He is scheming and greedy and cursing and rejecting God. So that's why the psalmist is asking this question. Again, go back to verse 1. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in time of trouble? And you imagine this is a theocracy. This is a place where the knowledge of the Lord is supposed to shine forth as a beacon to the nations around them. And the psalmist is looking around and he's saying, this is what I see. This is my experience. So what does he do? And he prays. And that prayer is seen in verses 12 through 15. And we could call this the call to arise. Verse 12 says, arise, O Lord, O God. Lift up your hand, forget not the afflicted. So there's this call for God to rise up and to make things right. Now, this is not the prayer of one who does not have faith. This is clearly the prayer of a man of faith, even in this this time of internal conflict where he's saying, Lord, you're standing off. Lord, you're hiding yourself. And I want you to see that. I want you to see how important that is, that the psalmist is both asking the questions, where are you, O Lord? And at the same time saying, Lord, rise up. He's showing his faith. It may be weak faith. It may be faith without vision, but it's faith. And he calls on God to rise up and to not forget the afflicted. He also, worth noting, doesn't begin this prayer with a call for retaliation. This is not really an imprecatory prayer. Instead, he calls for God to provide justice to the afflicted. That prayer in his mind, justice for the afflicted, is higher than the retribution or the retaliation that the psalmist may have a right to, and God definitely has a right to. Verse 14, the psalmist understands that God does see. You do see, for you note mischief and vexation, and you take that into your hands. Now, what I want you to notice here about the hands of the Lord is that the hands of the Lord will make justice certain on behalf of the afflicted. So notice how he says that. You note mischief and vexation, this is verse 14, that you may take it into your hands. So God is going to take into his hands those that need to be cared for, but he also is going to take into his hands that that discipline or that justice that is going to be poured out upon the wicked. But notice also these hands of the Lord. These are also going to be hands in which the afflicted commit themselves. Notice that. Also in verse 14, to you the helpless commits himself. You have been a helper of the fatherless. So the word commit that is in our the Pew Bible that we use, the English Standard Version, the word could also mean abandon. Just you're throwing yourself into the hands of the Lord, knowing that all of this need for justice and this need for the Lord to arise and this need for these questions to be answered. You may not get those answers in this life, but the psalmist says to just throw yourself, to abandon yourself into the hands of the Lord, these same hands that will make justice possible and that will make all things right from him. So we abandon ourselves into the hands of the Lord. And then the psalm ends with a contrast. Psalms always have these, not always, psalms occasionally or often have these contrasts between God in the nations, or something great and something small, something righteous and something wicked. Those contrasts are frequently made. And here we see this contrast between the great and the small. Remember, the wicked is under this the impression that, you know, his wickedness is going to just be able to go on and on forever, and the joys of that and the fruit of that wickedness is just going to unfold in prosperity through his whole life. Well, the psalmist makes a contrast between the Lord, who is king forever, and the nations who the wicked fall under here are going to perish from the land. So I call the contrast the great and the small. The Lord is king forever. The nations perish that do not obey the Lord, and the afflicted are heard. The Lord hears the desire of the afflicted and strengthens their hearts and has his ear towards them. He cares for the fatherless and the oppressed. He does justice in that direction. So all of that, there's the Lord. He reigns over all the earth. He's king forever and ever. He's going to hear the desires of the afflicted. And that's you, if those questions from verse 1 are part of you, and that call to abandon yourself into the Lord, that's you. And so he hears that desire. He strengthens hearts. He inclines ears. He's going to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed. And then here's the contrast. So that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. So what's the contrast that he gives? Does he give the contrast that says, you know, the wicked are, you know, they're the ones that own all of this, that, and the other thing, and they're oppressing the poor, and they're the ones with power and might? He doesn't go to any of their power. He doesn't go to any of their might. He goes to the fact that they're dust. And that's the contrast. The Lord is king forever and ever, and man who is oppressing is dust. And he wants us to put that in perspective. Man is so puny in this psalm, and his oppression is compared with the Lord, who is king forever and ever. So in the psalm, we start with these two questions. Lord, why do you stand off? Why do you hide yourself? And we have a call for the Lord to arise. And not only does he provide justice, but he provides himself that we may cast ourselves, abandon ourselves into his arms, and receive not only salvation and mercy, but justice as well.